This fall, New Yorkers have been trying out demo versions of a new bike. In time, it could become as common as the city's yellow cabs. New York has chosen an Oregon company to set up a fleet of 10,000 rental bikes. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, April Baer explains how Alta Bike Share went from tiny startup to major player.
Alta founder Mia Burke likes to show off what's behind her office. It's Portland's only solar-powered bike share station.
It's a modular station. So any user would come up to the station, a member would have a fob, looks like this.
Burke demonstrates how clients will charge up electronic fobs with credit and release a sturdy street bike for a short-term rental.
You'd put your fob in here and a green light would come on, and when the green light comes on, boom, you just pull the bike out.
Burke used to work for the city of Portland. Then she started doing consulting work. When she went into business, she felt pretty isolated. So few people were trained to design the needed infrastructure.
We had this like self-fulfilling cycle going on, that these students come out of college in landscape architecture, architecture, engineering, and planning, grounded in a thinking around everybody's going to drive everywhere.
So she started teaching a class at Portland State University.
We had to break that by changing the academic offerings.
Before long, Burke had a pool of smart, talented people ready to work on bike projects. She created her own labor pool. The contract with New York is a watershed moment for Alta Bike Share. It won't be funded with taxpayer money. John Orcutt is with New York's Department of Transportation. He says the city kept a close eye on how other revenue models have panned out, particularly a big one in the UK, sponsored by Barclays Bank.
You know, we clearly took note of London's ability to land a major corporate sponsor. And, you know, obviously we in London are peers in terms of big market, you know, cities with huge numbers of eyeballs on the street.
Alta has to find a corporate sponsor to bankroll $50 million in startup costs in exchange for naming rights or ads on the bikes. Once the funding is secured, Alta expects to hire more than 200 people in New York to set up and maintain the system. The bikes themselves will come from a Canadian company that makes heavy-duty, theft-resistant bikes called Bixies for fleet use. Jeffrey Miller heads the Alliance for Biking and Walking. He says Mia Burke positioned Alta to be in the right place at the right time as bike shares took off.
She's the Steve Jobs of bicycling.
Alta set up successful bike shares using the Bixie system in Boston and Washington, D.C., which is the largest operating bike share in the country. Miller credits the company's rise to Burke's knowledge of how city bureaucracies and rental systems work.
I think it's remarkably rapid in that 2 years they've gone from starting a new business, you know, what's essentially going to be a $50 million contract.
The flexibility of the system is a plus. Riders want the bike when they want it, where they want it, not in the garage. Stations can be picked up and moved if they're not getting enough use. Mia Burke's influence is seen all over Portland's bike scene. Not only did she help design the city's key bikeways and mentor cohorts of bike engineers, she does her part to create the next generation of cyclists, too. This is a fundraising bike derby at her daughter's elementary school. The kids got sponsors, and now they're zipping around a traffic circle doing laps to raise money.
We got about 40% of our kids biking and walking now.
After big bike share successes back east, it's now coming home to Portland. The city is pursuing federal funding for its own bike share program, and Alta will likely bid on the project. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Portland, Oregon.
This is NPR News.
Now heading west to Billings, Montana. We've been sending our reporters across the country to hear the stories about hard times in America. However, in Billings, the land of the big sky, there aren't many clouds. Billings, a city of more than 100,000 people between Denver and Calgary, is weathering the economic storm better than many other communities in the country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has the story.
The weekly luncheon of the Billings Rotary Club begins with a solemn prayer.
Specifically, we pray for those without jobs in our country and those who are new in the job market, that they can find opportunities to support themselves and their families.
There's also a palpable sense of optimism and relief that Billings itself is being spared from the ravages of the economic crisis. The unemployment rate here is about 5.5%, far lower than the national average.
This recession did not leave us unscathed. However, we are very blessed to be here in a region that has such an abundance of natural resources.
Rick Lutold is a chairman of Sanderson Stewart, a land development firm. Like many businesses here in Billings, his company has a piece of the action in Williston, a small town about 5.5 hours drive away in North Dakota. It's ground zero for one of the biggest oil plays in American history. And that's just part of the natural resource boom in this region.
A lot of people will reflect on what's happening in North Dakota and Wyoming and in Colorado over into Utah with a natural resource play as the current gold rush. It's the gold rush here of this decade. So.
But a boom is always followed by a bust, and history has taught the people of Billings not to place all of their chips on oil.
It's not just natural resources.
Steve Arviskow is the executive director of Big Sky Economic Development. He says Billings' diversified economy has been growing slowly but consistently, 1.5% to 2% in the recent decade.
We're a regional trade center. We're an agricultural hub. Our financial services sector is strong. We're a regional center for healthcare, and we're doing state-of-the-art healthcare delivery here.
You'll see what he means when you walk into the atrium of the Billings Clinic. It's a nationally recognized hospital known for its clinical quality, patient safety, and service. A soothing piano greets patients and visitors. Doctor and CEO Nicholas Walter walks us through the three-story high atrium, which is flooded with natural light.
We want to create an environment that we call it healing environment. It's how rooms are set up for inpatients, the hallways, it's art. We would like to provide services at a level of excellence that otherwise would require people to travel across the country.
Yet people are traveling across the country to come here to Billings to find work. In a school gym, about 50 people of all ages are learning Western swing dance steps. And it's here we meet 29-year-old Verite Thalen. She's a college-educated nanny who came to Billings from Oregon, where she says most of her friends are looking for work.
And I'm like, always like, just move to Billings. A, you're my friend and I miss you. And B, there's a job here waiting for you, I promise. I know that because everywhere I go, there's always help wanted signs up. There's help wanted signs on restaurants. There's help wanted signs in retail stores. Banks even have help wanted signs up.
Billings has about $150 million worth of public and private construction ongoing or on the boards, including what will be one of the largest sporting goods stores in the world. But it's not like the city is on a spending spree. People in Montana are famously tight-fisted, which explains why there is no sales tax, and also why a local bond vote to build a new $16 million library was no slam dunk. Last week, the supporters of the library bond campaign gathered in a downtown sports bar to await the election results. The library bond failed 9 years ago, but the crowd felt that this time things would be different because there's a growing sense that Billings is on the move. So when the results were announced and the library bond was approved by 57% of voters, the bar erupted.
My name's Evelyn Nonig, and this is the best day of my life.
Evelyn Nonig is Billings Library Foundation president.
How do you explain that Billings is going to build a new library at a time when so many other communities across this country are laying off librarians and teachers and firefighters and police officers?
Billings has a wonderful cross-section of people who believe in our city. It's just a great day here in Billings.
And from nearly every indication, it could stay that way in Billings for quite a while. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News.
Another way the sluggish housing market is changing the way we live, the rise of reluctant landlords. People who want to sell their homes to pursue a job or relationship, but find their pride and joy sitting on the market for weeks and months without a buyer in sight. So would-be sellers often move on and instead of selling their homes, rent them, which means dealing with tenants. Sometimes that goes well and sometimes not so much. NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
So here's the tough talk that realtors often tell homeowners these days.
This is the new reality. Our market is You might sell your home or you might not.
So Chicago realtor Frank McGuire says that means
there is a whole world of people who are unintentional landlords.
Unintentional, accidental, reluctant, never in the world thought I would be a landlord, landlords. That's the fate of many a home buyer trying to sell these days. Sometimes it works out well. McGuire's next door neighbor is a good example.
My name is Paul Williams. I live in Rogers Park, and I moved here due to a job change.
Williams, along with his wife and young daughters, rent a home on Chicago's far north side. They also own a two-bedroom bungalow in Oakland, California, bought at the height of the housing boom.
We bought it at just over $500,000, and the last appraisal was at $260,000.
Ouch. Once they heard that appraisal, Williams says he and his wife decided not to sell, but instead to rent their home to a friend of a friend.
I'd owned rental property before and had almost a problem every month, and so was not very excited about the idea of becoming a landlord again. But we've been very fortunate to have a great tenant. Knock on wood, thus far, it's been very uneventful.
There's been a big jump in the number of single-family homes shifting into the rental market since the country's housing boom started to bust. Eric Belsky with Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says during the boom years between 2001 to 2005, about 700,000 single-family homes became rentals. The latest survey tracking housing units from 2005 to 2009 showed a significant increase.
2.3 million single-family homes flowed from having been owned to being rented. And they're not just being offered for rent, but they're actually occupied by renters.
In some areas, condominiums are the big market. Ron Abrams with the Chicago Association of Realtors says sellers still often test the market first and put their condo up for sale in hopes of getting a good deal. And many end up renting their units.
The good news for the owners or the reluctant landlords has been that the rental market has been so good that they've been able to cover pretty much all their expenses and just been able to basically go on with their lives.
Of course, some condo associations don't allow rentals or have certain restrictions. And sometimes it just doesn't turn out so rosy.
My first time being a landlord turned into a nightmare.
Jeanette Masterson says if she knew then what she knows now, she may never have become a landlord.
The only thing I knew was that if something was broken, I would have to fix it. I just assumed everyone would be a good renter. I approached it in a very naive fashion.
For about 3 years, Masterson lived in a two-bedroom condo that she bought for $173,000. After she married, she moved into her husband's larger condominium.
Originally, my condo was on the market for 8 or 9 months. A lot of showings, no offers. After we weren't able to sell it, we decided to rent it out to bring in some income to help cover the two mortgages that we now had together.
The rent covered Masterson's mortgage and assessments. The tenants paid all the utilities. They called often for small things and then wanted to break their lease. It turned into a legal quagmire and a battle over the security deposit. When the saga came to an end, Masterson tried again to sell her unit. It stayed empty for almost a year. A realtor helped her find a property management firm, which rented the condo right away.
We're losing about $600 a month.
But at this point, Masterson says they're just trying to minimize their loss, and they're able to do it with a lot less stress.
I'm not on pins and needles every day wondering if I'm going to get a call about something stupid. Again, as a landlord, that's something I had to accept. But now I don't have to worry about it, having a property management company working for us, managing my condo.
Masterson says her best advice to accidental or reluctant landlords, be prepared, because it's not an easy job. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
President Obama left town this morning for the third Asia trip of his presidency. Before visiting Australia and Indonesia, he will begin in Hawaii, where leaders from around the Pacific region are gathering for the APEC summit. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports on the incentives pulling Mr. Obama across the ocean and the forces tugging on him to stay at home.
Every year, the German Marshall Fund surveys Americans' attitudes toward the rest of the world. This year, the poll found something surprising.
We saw a big shift this year when the majority of Americans say that their country's national interest is with the countries of Asia.
This is Jolt Nyeri, who runs the Transatlantic Trends Report for the Marshall Fund. In every previous survey, Americans said their country's future lies with Europe. but no longer.
We found this to be the case, especially for the American youth. Those Americans who are between the ages of 18 to 24, 76% of them said that Asia is more important for their national interest than the countries of the European Union.
President Obama might never want to put it in such stark terms. After all, he doesn't want to offend America's European allies. But his administration shares this view. Here's how President Obama greeted South Korea's President Lee Myung-bak at the White House last month.
The United States is a Pacific nation, and America is leading once more in the Asia-Pacific.
By leading in the Asia-Pacific, President Obama means in part, we're not just buying from China anymore, we're selling. At the White House this week, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes explained that this region's growing middle class can be a market for American goods.
The vast majority of the export potential in the world is in the Asia-Pacific. So when the president sets the goal of doubling U.S. exports to support hundreds of thousands of American jobs, again, that's very much going to be rooted in our ability to open markets in the Asia-Pacific.
Congress recently passed a free trade agreement with South Korea. On this trip, President Obama is working on a larger trade deal involving 9 countries spanning both sides of the Pacific Ocean. The message from the White House is that by flying halfway around the world, President Obama is helping folks back home on the mainland. Not everyone is convinced, says Ernest Bauer. He directs the Southeast Asia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
There is pressure here not to do the trip, and it's always better to be in Indiana than Indonesia.
That pressure seems to arise any time President Obama goes abroad for more than a few days. He twice postponed an earlier Asia trip to deal with the Gulf oil spill and the health care debate. He was criticized for going ahead with a trip to Latin America just as NATO started bombing Libya. Those pressures to stay home are even stronger with a presidential election just 1 year off. But Bauer says cutting this trip short would be a mistake.
It would underlie a narrative that the Chinese have promoted in some sense, that the Americans are interested in Asia, but they're not consistently engaged.
What President Obama leaves behind is a congressional supercommittee that's crashing on a deadline to find more than $1 trillion in deficit reduction. In public, the members have appeared dysfunctional and gridlocked. Some people have urged President Obama to get more deeply involved in the negotiations, saying a hands-off approach shows a lack of leadership. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg spoke this week in Washington.
The executive branch must do more than submit a plan to a committee and then step aside and hope the committee members take action.
But the president has recently been washing his hands of Congress. In event after event, his motto has been,
"We're going to act on our own because we can't wait for Congress to help our families and our economy."
So Mr. Obama is leaving the country, returning just 3 days before the congressional supercommittee's due date. And instead of spending the next week wading through the partisan muck, he'll speak to an international audience where he's more popular and perhaps more influential. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.